area, we're at 90.9 FM, and in the Lompoc-Vandenberg Village area, we are at 95.1 FM. It's 1 o'clock, time for Issues and Ideas. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Coming up on today's program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to the Monterey County Agricultural and Rural Life Museum at King City's San Lorenzo County Park. The museum features a restored one-room schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, more than 30 ancient farm tractors, and lots more. Also, Chrissy Hewitt and Stephen DeLuque bring us another edition of Ears on Art. This week, they begin a two-part conversation with artist and longtime Cuesta College instructor Barry Franz, whose work will be featured at an exhibition at the Cuesta Art Gallery later this month. Learn about his art, influences, and philosophical inspirations for his work. But up first, September is National Preparedness Month. Marisa Waddell talks with local Red Cross Executive Director Lauren Avila about what we can do in our own homes and businesses to be ready for emergencies and disasters.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. On the Central Coast, we face any number of potential emergencies, from fires and earthquakes to tsunamis, floods, and even nuclear emergencies. Well, September is National Preparedness Month, so now is the time to think about what we'll do in case of an emergency or disaster. With me today to help us understand how we might be more ready is Lauren Leidinger Avila, who's the Executive Director of the Red Cross San Luis Obispo Chapter. Welcome to you, Lauren.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear a story, just right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Tell me a story about how being ready helped a family or an individual in an emergency.
Well, one that comes to mind actually is about a woman who kept seeing a billboard about, you know, get ready, you need to be prepared. And she lived in an area, she actually lived in the Midwest, and they had never had any emergency. She'd lived in the same home for 30 years, but she kept seeing the billboard, you know, get prepared, be ready. And it stuck with her. So she started doing some research. She looked at the Red Cross website and started to get things prepared to make sure she had enough water, that she had a little extra food, flashlights, kind of other emergency supplies. And sure enough, about 3 weeks later, a tornado hit their community and hit their home. Wow. It was destroyed. But they were able to stay in the home, in the part that was, you know, still habitable, mm-hmm. With the supplies that she had gathered. And when emergency personnel came by and checked on them, are you okay? Do you need anything? She said, you know what? We're fine. Go take care of other people who need help more than we do. And that's one of the key messages about preparedness that we try to share, is that not only do you help yourself in those situations, but emergency responders can then focus their attention on people who are really in dire need, you know, mm-hmm. in situations like that.
So just as long as we can get along okay,
yeah.
there might be somebody else who really is in need of much more attention.
Yes, yes.
What are some of the most common emergencies that we face that actually happen on the Central Coast on a regular basis?
The most common one we have in the Central Coast is single-family home fires or multi-family home fires. Here, just in San Luis Obispo County, we respond to about 30 of those types of incidents every year. Usually it's a family with, you know, several children, adults living together. And that is the most common disaster that we have. Mainly, the Red Cross responds whenever someone loses access to their primary place of residence. So we've had, you know, trees fall on mobile homes. We've had homes flooded. But fires are the number one.
So when we say preparedness, we're not just talking about the big earthquake. We're talking about being ready in case you have a fire in your house or a tree falls on it.
Exactly, exactly. And it's the little things that I think people don't think about. But imagine waking up in the middle of the night. You smell smoke. There are flames around you. Your first instinct is to get out as quickly as possible. But if you have a bag or have a few things by your bedside or near your front door or your escape routes, you're going to be in better shape. A lot of people will leave without their glasses. And, you know, the Red Cross can help people get, you know, glasses replaced or prescriptions refilled or grabbing your pet. So just kind of thinking about these things beforehand will get you in a better place for that emergency situation where it's hard to think about everything in that moment.
So what are the most common things that we can do to actually prepare for an emergency?
Well, number one is knowing, you know, what the risks are. So knowing, you know, what the hazards are in your community, like fires, earthquakes, some of the things you've already talked about. Having a plan. So whether you live alone or have family members living with you, have a plan. If there's a fire in the home, where are we going to meet outside of the home? If we can't get back to our home, where is that place we're going to meet? Down the block or in another neighboring town to kind of regroup together. Having emergency contact numbers, knowing what prescriptions you take, things like that, that, again, are going to be hard to remember at the last minute. The other thing is to make a kit. Mm-hmm. So having a small bag, you know, either by your bedside or in your car of essential items. The things you want to have are, you know, emergency water, maybe if you can have a vacation supply of prescriptions, an extra pair, an old pair of glasses, a little bit of food. So, you know, food that will last well in your car, granola bars or something like that, mm-hmm. flashlight, of course. So, you know, kind of the basics so that if you need to be away from your home for a couple of days, you're kind of set.
I saw a funny PSA on your website where a man was showing his wife the emergency kit that he put together, and it had chocolate frosting and a shoehorn and pancake mix and
yeah.
things like that. So you mentioned some of the basic things that should go in a kit. Should a kit be just small and ready to go, or should we have like a big trash can full of stuff? Where should it live?
You actually ideally would have both. So you would kind of have your go kit, something that's a backpack size that you could, you know, either pick up right before you leave your home or that you have in your vehicle that has some of the basics that I've talked about. And then you should have a place. It doesn't have to be. A lot of people do have kind of that giant garbage can at home of all their supplies, or you can have a cabinet or, a closet in your home where you have those supplies. Because usually what we have learned in this industry, in this field, is that if there's a large emergency, people should expect to be on their own for about 5 days before mm-hmm. kind of a larger response comes. I mean, the Red Cross will be there, but you really should be able to, you know, have enough food and water for 5 days.
So when you say make a plan, what does a plan look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, at our website, redcross.org/prepare, we have some sample plans that people can use and print out. The most important thing is thinking about those things that you need, you know, whether it's supplies, contact information, whatever it may be. But it's really thinking through what could happen and how is my family going to respond. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Lauren Leidinger-Avila, who's the executive director of the Red Cross San Luis Obispo chapter. And we're talking about National Preparedness Month. That's what September is all about, is getting ready for an emergency. And Lauren is here to help us understand better how we can do that. So in an emergency plan, there are things that we might not be able to plan for. Like, what if I am in a different city working than my children who are going to school?
Mm-hmm.
How do we deal with something like that? Or my elderly parent who's in a care facility?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a few different things. One is that all of our schools have emergency preparedness plans. So as a parent, you know, I would say definitely feel empowered to ask the principal or the administration at your schools to see the plan. I know my kids are part of the San Luis Obispo Unified School District, and, you know, everything I've gotten has a plan for if there were some sort of, you know, nuclear incident. But they also have plans for, you know, earthquakes and fires and other things that might happen. So definitely feel empowered to ask for that information. The other thing is it's always good to have an out-of-town contact. So not only knowing each other's phone numbers and trying to call each other, but a lot of times in a local emergency, it's hard. You know, the cell phone lines are all jammed. You can't get through locally, but you can call someone who lives in another state. So we always recommend having an out-of-town contact. The other thing is texting. If you have texting ability, is a good way to communicate, because the text will keep trying to get sent through, even if maybe the lines are down or there's a delay for some reason. It'll keep trying, you know, pretty much forever until it actually goes through. The same thing for, you know, parents or, you know, people you care about that are in care facilities. You should definitely see if they have an emergency plan. We offer emergency preparedness training programs for seniors, those with disabilities, children, businesses. We'd be happy to come out and, you know, do some presentations and get people thinking about what to do when those situations happen. It's always better to plan ahead, you know, and this is why I love preparedness. The more that we can plan ahead, the quicker, you know, we're all going to recover from the experience.
Yeah. I think about the horrible pictures that we saw in a disaster like Katrina, for instance. And there were all kinds of horrible images of human suffering, but also people not being able to take their pets along. How do we plan for our pets?
Yep. I can tell you that in San Luis Obispo County, we have a plan kind of and partners that we work with for pets. So Woods Humane Society, HEAT, you know, for larger animals like horses.
Which we have a lot of on the
Which we have Coast. A lot of. So basically, if the Red Cross opens a shelter for people, you know, to come to for support or shelter, food, et cetera, we'll have a partner agency that will also work with the animals. The Red Cross can accept service animals into shelters, but if it's, you know, other animals would be located nearby and managed by the experts.
My dog has medication that he has to be on for his heart. And so will there be folks who can give the animals their medications and things like that?
Yes, definitely. There are always lots of volunteers, people willing to help humans and pets. But I would definitely say as a part of your emergency plan, you should know what, you know, dosage, what is the name of the medicine your pet is on. If you can have a little extra, you know, ask the vet to, you know, write a little extra prescription for you to put in that kit that you grab when you leave your home. Yeah, definitely don't forget your pets. They need our support too and love.
Tell me about some of the information that the Red Cross has available online, because I know you have apps and other information.
Yes, we actually have a number of free apps that are available for iPhone and Android users. One of my favorites is the First Aid app, and basically it will provide you with step-by-step instructions to help you work through any sort of, you know, medical emergency, whether it's cardiac arrest, anaphylactic shock, you know, from an allergic reaction to a bee sting or eating nuts or whatever it might be. It'll walk you through those scenarios. But it also has a great preparedness section to it. So it'll walk you through how to prepare for different types of emergencies. So there's earthquake, tornado, flood, wildfire, hurricane. And they're kind of nice, even if I know we're not in a tornado area. But if you travel at all in an area that's, you know, prone to tornadoes, it's good to download it because you'll get an alert.
Does Red Cross offer any supplies for sale? Like, do you have kits? I saw some backpacks on your website that looked like they had some emergency supplies.
We do. We do. On our website, redcross.org, there are a number of different kits. Usually there's a one-person three-day kit and a two-person three-day kit. But I would encourage folks to look at our website, look at the list of things that we recommend you put in your kit and make it yourself. You don't have to spend a lot of money. You don't have to buy a Red Cross product. It'd be, you know, it's great to support the organization, of course, but these things can be made pretty easily and pretty economically using the things that you like on your own.
Are there any activities or events that the local chapter has coming up to help folks get ready during National Preparedness Month?
Yeah, the big one is Sheriff's Day at the Ranch. It's happening at the Madonna Inn on September 14th, pretty much all day, 10 to 3. It's a great event. We'll have a number of volunteers in our emergency response vehicle there educating people about preparedness. And we'll be debuting our one of our new characters to help educate children about preparedness. His name is Preparity Cat, and we're very excited about that. So that would be a great way for the community to come out and learn about preparedness. We also have an event we're doing with the Chamber of Commerce here on October 1st. It's business preparedness for small and medium-sized businesses, and the Chamber will have information up on its website next week if people are interested.
Okay. September is National Preparedness Month. And Lauren Leidinger-Avila, the Executive Director of the Red Cross San Luis Obispo chapter, is telling us about how we can be better prepared. If anyone wants further information, how does one find that?
Yes, feel free to give us a call. Our number here locally is 805-543-0696. We'd be happy to come out and do a presentation to your school, your church, your community group. We just want to get all the information out there.
And the website is redcross.org.
Correct.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
Thank you so much.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still to come on today's program, we learn about artist and longtime Cuesta College instructor Barry Franz on another edition of Ears on Art. His work will be featured at an exhibition in the Cuesta Art Gallery later this month. But up next, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to the Monterey County Agricultural and Rural Life Museum at King City's San Lorenzo County Park, one of the Central Coast's best-kept secrets. He visits with the museum's executive director, Jessica Potts.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
For more than 20 years, I frequently commuted between the Monterey Peninsula and San Luis Obispo County, traveling along U.S. Highway 101. I love it when I have a little extra time to explore the side roads and backcountry in close proximity to Highway 101. One of my favorite detours is a trip out to Mission San Antonio that's located on Hunter Liggett Army Base. It's a 25-mile one-way drive, but well worth the time. For years, when I traveled through King City, I'd notice a sign on the side of the road entitled San Lorenzo County Park, and then something about RV parking. And then one day I thought, I'm going to see what this park is all about. I exited the freeway at the northern end of King City, and mere yards away was the entrance to San Lorenzo County Park, and was just blown away by what I found there. Yes, there's RV camping and there's tent camping with more than 90 campsites, but the real gem was to discover that the park is a showcase of the Salinas Valley's agricultural history. And the centerpiece showcase is the Monterey County Agricultural and Rural Life Museum. The other day I stopped in and the timing was excellent. When I entered the old 1903 King City train station, there was Jessica Potts, the executive director of the Monterey County Agricultural Rural Life Museum. I asked her if she had time to chat and she gladly agreed. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Jessica Potts at the San Lorenzo County Park in King City.
The dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Hi, Jessica. Tell us about Monterey County's best-kept secret in parkland right here in King City.
We're located in a beautiful county park of over 200 acres, has some really great camping, full hookup, RV. It's a really great stop when you're passing through 101. And a part of the park is a museum, which actually has seven buildings. We focus on agriculture and rural life at the turn of the century up to World War II. And we have some actual historical buildings. We have the King City Train Depot, which was a part of King City. And we have a one-room schoolhouse, which is a very important part of our school tour program, as well as a farmhouse that was on the Spreckles Ranch, a blacksmith shop, a tractor barn, a regular exhibit barn that covers agriculture as it grew through the time span, as well as a history of irrigation museum.
You have a lot of outdoor exhibits. How many tractors do you have here that are scattered throughout the property?
30 to 40 pieces of equipment. A good majority of them run. There's a lot of farm implements also that we have on display out in the park, which adds a really nice touch to the area.
So on special event days, you fire up some of the tractors and the kids can watch them operate?
We definitely do. One of the days that you'll see most of them in action is the 4th of July. We participate in the annual town parade. And this year we had 16 tractors that not only were up and running, but they made it there and back. So that was a great accomplishment.
Oh, what a day. That sounds like fun. Great photo opportunity, I
bet. Definitely is.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit more. This is a place that somebody heading north or south on 101 could stop in for an hour or two, or you could spend a weekend, literally. You could set up camp or set up your RV, right?
You definitely can. It's a great place to stop and use as a restroom break on your way through to have a nice picnic or come for the weekend. There is a lot to do in the area as well as here at the park. It would take you a good couple hours to really see the museum in its entirety. And then there's the wine industry that's here locally. It's a really great stopping point.
We are right in front of the train depot.
Correct. This is the King City Train Depot, and as I said, it was located on First Street in King City. It was used, is actually a functioning train depot. It was moved down here in the late 80s to save it from destruction. It was renovated and is now, not only has a conference room, but it has a really great museum that shows what a train depot would have looked like during that time period.
And let's talk school. I've been here before. One of my most memorable little moments was in the one-room schoolhouse. That is well done. Give us a word picture.
It is definitely one of our crowning jewels of the museum. We use it heavily for the school tour program. Between April and June, we see just over 1,400 third and fourth graders from Monterey County come through here, and they are able to spend a day in the life of a student at the turn of the century. You take them into the schoolhouse, they're able to sit down in a desk, use a slate, use chalk, see what it was really like for a student back then, compare it to their life nowadays, getting there, the difficulties, how important school was to a student back then. So it really is a wonderful aspect of our museum.
Tell us about some of your other favorite things not to be missed experiences here.
The exhibit barn itself is really great because it has a lot of hands-on interactions. We try to keep the museum so that a student can come in, get an educational experience, but have fun doing it. And so that's why I think that exhibit is really great. It starts from the mission times with the Indians, moves around up to, it ends with a town scene. So you kind of get a feeling of agriculture through the valley as well as a small community. And as I said, there's a lot of hands-on, and every time we upgrade an exhibit, we try to incorporate that. One of the other things that we do is really neat is we have a working blacksmith shop, and we are only able to get it open and running a couple times a year, but when we do, it's really a sight to be seen. This year we had a class with a local 4-H, and they were able to come in, and we had about 16 students come in and use a couple of the forges, make some iron, bend some iron, you know, with the heat, and it was really, really a great experience.
That's so cool. So they really get a palpably living history experience here.
Yes, they do. And then when we are able to get the tractors out and we have that, there's some really unique pieces that they actually get to see started up and moving. So that's really great, too.
Tell us some more. This is just wonderful.
The History of Irrigation Museum is one of our newest museums. It came in the early 90s, and it has a theater in it. And so there's a wonderful movie on irrigation in the Salinas Valley that teaches the students quite a bit when they come through. And it's also a favorite of adult visitors as well. The Spreckles House is a really unique experience. You get to walk through a farmhouse and see how small and what life would have been like back then with the limitations that they would have had. The children are always amazed at, well, what do they do? How do they entertain themselves? And so that's really a great opportunity also.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Spreckles House. Tell us about the gable end, the signature.
Well, you could recognize a house by its front. The gable would signify whether it was a townhouse or a ranch house. I think a unique thing to know about the park itself is that this was originally a Spreckles ranch.
Oh, it was. Interesting.
Yes, it was. The house here that we have comes from Ranch 1, so it was not this ranch. This was actually Ranch 3, but that's where this area originates.
This was a sugar beet ranch? What did Spreckles do here?
Yes, he did sugar beets. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of our starting functions here. We had a board member who was very involved in the sugar beets, and so that was a really, you know, close to his heart function. You can see there's a sign over there shows sugar beets. In our harvester barn, there is a sugar beet harvester. So there are some really unique pieces of equipment that go along with those. The house itself was brought here in the early 80s. It was one of the original buildings. The barn that I mentioned earlier is a replica, and it was one of the first buildings built. But at the same time, they're also working on getting the La Gloria Schoolhouse in and the Spreckles House in. So they are one of the original part of the original museum.
Your position with Monterey County Agricultural and Rural Life Museum, is it all focused here at the San Lorenzo Park, or do you do things throughout the county?
I am focused here at the park, at the museum. One of my big focuses is on programming and promoting of the museum. We want to start reaching out to the outlying areas to let them know what we have down here. I think that we kind of consider ourselves a hidden jewel of the Monterey County, because really there's not a lot of knowledge about us, and we've been here since the early 80s. So we have quite a history here. It's just now time to start letting people know about it.
I think you hit it on the head, because I'm a travel journalist specializing in the California Central Coast, and I discovered this place by accident. It was just out of pure curiosity that I thought, what is that place that I drove in? Mm-hmm. It truly is a best-kept secret of the Salinas Valley.
I think so, and I hear that story quite a bit, even from the people that live here just right across the wall from us. We have a lot of people that say, oh, I've never been there. We recently had an exhibit called The Bittersweet Harvest, the Bracero Program. It visited from the Smithsonian.
Nice.
And one of the...
And that was right here at San Lorenzo Park.
It was. It was here. It was right here for 8 weeks. It was a fabulous exhibit. But we had such great feedback. And we had a couple visit us. It was a brother and two sisters. And she had lived here for 70 years, she said, and had never come here. Had
wow.
used the park, has been to events here at the park, but has never been to the museum. And they ended up spending a couple hours here, just were amazed at what there was. We hear all the time, I can't believe how wonderful this place is. And so I think that once you've been here, you know what you found, but you have to find it first.
Talk a little bit more about your vision and going forward, some of the programs that you're planning.
Well, we're actually working on a program that is really exciting. We have been selected by the American Alliance of Museums to partner with a museum internationally to work on a garden program, to do an educational garden. And this area between the history of irrigation building and the tractor barn, we're going to turn into an educational garden. And we're going to partner with the Greenfields Community Science Workshop. And they're going to have some kids that are going to be involved with some kids here locally in King City. We're going to work together to build this garden. There's going to be an international aspect where we will partner with another museum and they will do something very likewise. The kids will interact with each other, will learn from each other. So it's a really exciting program that we're just now trying to pull together, and we'll be getting going in the next month or so. We also have quite a bit of other little things that we just did our South County Ag Tour, which we take a group of people around the South County and let them have an insight to some of the industry. I mean, we're a $4 billion industry here, and there's not a lot of opportunity to get behind the scenes views of it, and this really allows that. We also do a storytelling program where we have kids come in and we read to them, do a craft with them, trying to instill the love of reading, because it's kind of one of those things that with computers and TV, people don't read as much, and so we really wanted to help out with that. We also do a Christmas holiday open house where we provide crafts and movies and stuff for the children. It's free of charge. We've done a cookie where we give cookies to the 400 Liggett troop. So there's a lot that we're trying to do for the community.
I guess the key question is, for further information,
you can call 831-385-8020, or our website is mcarlm.org, or you can find us on Facebook.
I'm Tom Wilmer. We've been visiting with Jessica Potts, the executive director at the Monterey County Agricultural and Rural Life Museum in King City, California, at the San Lorenzo County Park.
The dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
This is Public Radio KCBX. Next on Ears on Art, Chrissy Hewitt and Stephen DeLuque begin a two-part conversation with artist and longtime Cuesta College instructor Barry Franz. Support for KCBX comes from the San Luis Obispo edition of Walk to End Alzheimer's. This year's walk will be held September 21st, starting in Laguna Lake Park. More information is at act.alz.org/SLO. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. On today's episode, a mission scientist with NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, Natalie Battaglia, hunts for exoplanets, Earth-sized planets beyond our solar system that might harbor life. She speaks about unexpected connections between things like love and dark energy, science and gratitude, and how exploring the heavens brings the beauty of the cosmos and the exuberance of scientific discovery closer to all of us. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Form, balance, and dirt. We talk with a lifelong devotee to the versatility of clay. Coming up. Hello, I am Stephen DeLuque, and along with Krissa Hewitt, producer and host of this program, Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced here at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving California's Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Today, Krissa and I have the honor of talking with Barry Franz, one of the trio of instructors who created and nurtured the art department curriculum at Cuesta College. Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, constructed the exemplary art department out at Cuesta College seemingly out of thin air. The trio transformed derelict Camp San Luis Obispo buildings into an exciting and inspiring environment for the students. The Cuesta College Art Gallery is honoring the three founding fathers with individual art shows, but more about that later. Here's Barry to share his story.
Stephen and I are here in the studio with Barry Franz. Good afternoon.
Hi, Krissa. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, all.
Barry, your career at Cuesta has been a very long one, and you've been gone from there for a while, I believe. But before we get into that, your career as an artist, when did all of that start?
Well, I was always the best one with the paper and the scissors in kindergarten and in church school. So, it's from the beginning. Explored other things like natural history and forestry, biology. I ended up back in art because that's just what I was supposed to do, I guess. And it's been a fortunate career. It wasn't the most intelligent solution, but it worked, and I'm extremely fortunate.
Okay, I'm curious, what sorts of things were you making out of cut-up paper?
Well, I've been all my life interested in Native American crafts, and I don't know how many of those are made out of paper, but I sure made a lot of things out of sticks and feathers and made bows and arrows and primitive weapons, and I practiced on my dear sister as she'd run out the door. I'd flop her in the back with a blunt arrow or something. I spent a lot of time down on the river. I was a sort of a Huckleberry Finn kind of guy until I finished high school and went to college and started getting some serious academics. And then I became a Europhile, interested in all the literature and art, all the avant-garde stuff that was happening over there. Plus the beat movement in San Francisco was happening, so that intrigued me. I was always curious about alternative ways of looking. Growing up in a tiny, tiny Central Valley town, there wasn't much going on there that could sustain my curiosity. My dear grandmother always subscribed to the National Geographic magazine, through which I explore the rest of the world. And then as soon as I finished junior college, preparing for traveling abroad, I studied Spanish and English and German and French, grabbed a bus and took off when I was 20 and spent a year thumbing around in Europe, ending up finding a job as a ceramic apprentice in Bavaria, which was wonderful, but boy, they work you all hard. And I thought, I probably need to get back to the States and get into a real program. And so that's what I did. But along the way, I picked up my wife, Barbara, German. We met hitchhiking and hanging out in youth hostels. So I brought her back to Empire, California, east of Modesto, about 5 miles, where Highway 132 crosses the Santa Fe Railroad tracks. And it's an old Church of the Brethren town founded by wheat farmers coming out from Kansas, and my grandfather was the minister in the little brick church there. God, it was a horrible place. Middle of the summer, 110 degrees, but that's all gone now. It's a real vital Mexican town now. All the old people died, moved away, But now you drive in there, it's you know, everything's thriving, but it's all in Spanish. So that's where I left, you know, 60 years ago, I left that town and only went back to see my family. But it was a good place to grow up.
I'm a graduate of Sonora High School, so...
Sonora? Uh-huh. That's Tuolumne Fire is getting close to Sonora.
Not quite close enough.
It's sure burning my old stomping grounds. That I spent every summer in the Sierras up on a Sonora Pass at a Boy Scout camp. And then we had a church camp farther up on Sonora Pass and spent at least half the summer up there every year, as long as I can remember.
I worked for the Forest Service for two summers when I was in the university, and I was assigned Emigrant Basin. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're country boys.
That was my favorite place for many years.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a sister. Were there other siblings?
I have a sister and a brother. They're both younger, and they both still live in the area there.
Did either of them, when they weren't being shot in the back, have interest in creating things, or were
Not
you the
thing.
Soul?
I was the sole creative person. My dad was a painter, a contractor, and my brother took over the business. My sister went to work with her husband in the fruit agricultural processing businesses over there along the railroad track. And no, nothing particularly creative in the family. I don't know where it came from.
We often don't. You mentioned being in a ceramic manufacturing.
Hans Eske was equivalent to a PhD in ceramic art and technology from the university in Munich. He was really well renowned and did a lot of ceramic murals for post offices and schools, as well as pottery. But when I was there, we were making tile for architectural murals. Way out in the country in a little place called Mittergars. The roads weren't even paved, but there was a little tiny called a shinbus, a little trolley on rails that would go out there through the villages. That was the only way to get into town, unless you wanted to walk. And to get into Munich, I would walk about 10 miles and start hitchhiking on the main road in Munich and spend the weekend and looking up Barbara, who had a job there at Siemens, and then I'd have to make my way back, get home late Sunday evening and have to get up early Monday morning back to work. It was kind of fun.
How did you find out about that?
Well, I was in Innsbruck, and they have this castle there in the middle of town. Make available some spaces in there for local artists. And I met this guy, Arno Lehmann, who was a ceramic artist. I was just walking around touring the castle, saw him in there and went in and started talking to him. My German had gotten pretty good because I'd spent a while with an exchange student I knew good. We had a conversation. I told him I was interested in ceramic art and where would I go if, you know, I wanted to get an education. And he had all kinds of suggestions. And then finally at the end he said, but you know, I have this friend over across the border back in Germany. He has lots of work. He could hire you, you know, as an apprentice. Get back over there, get on the shinbus and go out there and knock on his door in the middle of winter with my California khakis and a little corduroy jacket with snow on my shoulders. And he found it so curious, he hired me. And it turned out about every week somebody would show up knocking on the door. This guy was sending people all the time. And he thought I was an oddity, so he took me on. And it was great.
And you were there how long?
6 months before I realized that, you know, I really need proper education.
Going to college?
Well, I could see that an apprenticeship, you know, was a long road of them. So I came back, and a friend of mine from MJC had gone to San Jose State. They had the second largest art program in the state at that time and a big ceramic program. So I just went over there. Closest place for me, something I could maybe afford. I had no money from my family, no scholarships, no student loans at that time, so I had to work my way through, you know, half-time, part-time. Sometimes I had to work full-time, and then my grades suffered, but, you know, it was, I could work all day and work all night and make it work.
What years are we talking about?
Oh, I went to San Jose State in 61 and left there in 67, BA, and then the MA in ceramic art. They hired me to stay on and teach for 2 years as a replacement for sabbatical leave people, so I was a bona fide associate professor with a CTA card in my pocket, and there weren't very many jobs available. I got sort of one of the last ones. Good old Chet Amix. Good old Chet Amix. He changed my life by choosing me. And it turned out to be a great place. At that time, it was like the end of the world for the art, for an artist. There was nothing here. And I'd been showing with my professor colleagues up there in the Bay Area, the Young, and up in Richmond and all around the Bay Area. But down here, you know, it was just a different world. It was a cow town with Aggies poking hippies with prodding sticks. But we got in on the ground floor. We were able to build a program out there, design the curriculum, design the facilities, work with local students. It was wonderful. We worked our butts off, you know. I mean, our studio classes were two units, meaning we had to teach like four classes a week. And then I'd come back in the evening and teach a couple extra evening classes and get home about midnight and have to be back out there at 7:30 in the morning. But it was great.
If we go back to the clay, mostly hand-building sculptural forms.
I got hooked on clay in a pottery class at MJC, throwing on the wheel. I thought that was really neat. And then I got exposed to the other aspects of it working in Germany. And when I came back, I decided, well, you know, ceramics is great because it has so many facets. There's the technical aspect, clay chemistry and the glaze formulas. There's the engineering of the kilns and all the pyrotechnics. There's the history. It goes back in history in ancient China and everywhere. And there's the aesthetic. It's an art form where you have to do with design. So I thought, maybe I wouldn't get bored with this. I didn't want to get locked into something that was too narrow. And ceramics certainly isn't. It's a wonderful, wonderful medium.
You are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. We return to our guest, ceramicist Barry Franz, one of the founders of the art curriculum at Cuesta College. Barry has been extolling the versatility of working with clay, but, as he explains, there is one major drawback.
But it's just so damn messy, you know. After 10 years, I was just so tired of wiping that mud off my hands. Some days I just could hardly bear going into the studio thinking, another day in the mud room, you know. So, and when it became possible to add a new wing onto the building for sculpture, I was glad to take that over and hire Gaila Amix to take over that ceramics program. So from that point on, I taught some ceramic sculpture, but mostly I was over there setting up the foundry and the metal welding and the plaster and the wood and all those other media that we taught in sculpture.
Messy enough were those too, but yeah. A little different than the clay.
Clay just, well, you can track it forever. You can never get it off your shoes.
It becomes a part of you, I think, after a while. It goes into your pores. It's
well, and certainly plaster, I think, does much the same thing. I have wonderful imagery of the footprints at Poly going down the neat, clean hallway of the graphic designers.
Neither of those media have I used here at home because my studio is 10 feet from the back door. And I would be in big trouble if I started tracking plaster and clay through the house.
Well, and as somebody who's carved marble, I can tell you that dust tends to cling a lot, too. So we'd use the air hose and do a little blow-off job every day as you'd leave, and then you get home, and then you'd sit down and go, oh,
you just
didn't quite get it.
Yeah, grit. It's a great thing.
Who are some of the people in the medium of clay that have been inspiring to you?
Oh, I worked with Robert Arneson for a summer. He was a great inspiration.
He was at?
At Davis.
At Davis, okay.
Yeah. He was the guy that did all those iconic self-portraits. The one of Moscone up in San Francisco.
Right. I remember the work, and I was just trying to go, was this Oakland College of Arts and Crafts, or was it Davis?
And we had him come down and do a workshop down here, which is wonderful. He was a real character. Somewhere there's a film of him where we plastered him with clay, a little Super 8 movie, and then as it dried, he cracked it.
Besides being dirty or being dirt, clay does have that wonderful spontaneity to it that other materials can't quite match.
Definitely mud. But one of the other inspirations was Japanese ceramics. Living over in the valley there, one of my inspirations was Alan Watts. He came to us on educational television from KQED, and he was illustrating Japanese calligraphy, you know, wearing this funny little kimono, and talking about Zen and, you know, Buddhism. Fascinated me. So I almost went to Japan instead of Europe. I was so interested in Oriental arts. And then when I was at San Jose the second year, my professor, Herb Sanders, who had done a sabbatical in Japan, had Hamada? Shoji Hamada.
Oh, yay for
you,
me.
Good for you. God, you know, we still have some communal brain cells. Yeah, he had him come up for a workshop. And I was the only one in the program at San Jose State that he invited to participate. Everyone else was from all the universities around the country. It was a real honor.
Boy.
Trouble is, it influenced me so heavily, I was making Japanese pottery. And I'd make stuff, and it'd be coming out of the kiln, and these guys would say, is this one of the shochis? You know, well, who's made this thing? You know, I was embarrassed to say, that's mine. But I eventually had to just say, no more Japanese style. I changed consciously and directly. But still, when I sit down at the potter's wheel, instinctively I start making Japanese pots. It's just ingrained. But I had to consciously stop doing that and start using other techniques, really. Even with clay, I'd do hand building and modeling and stuff that made it impossible to duplicate those things that I'd picked up from Shoji Hamada.
If you were to give a visual to Japanese ceramics, what would it be?
Well, they're beautifully simple forms, spontaneously made. There's no, you know, precision particularly. There's just an elegance, and wonderfully organic looking glazes made from natural materials and beautiful brushwork.
There was a film that we used to show. Henry Wessel showed it, and I showed it to some different classes, that was a Japanese pottery house, and of course just so steeped in tradition and watching the elders teaching the younger people how to throw. But the most wonderful part about that film that I will never forget was they had been in production, a process called, I believe, throwing on the hump, where you have a big mound of clay, mm-hmm. you're just using the top little part of it and making a piece and cutting it off and then starting to work all over again. And they would put these bowls on these planks of wood, and then somebody would carry them out to the yard to start drying. Well, it was Japan, and it was rain season or whatever, so all of a sudden you're hearing all this commotion, and the women had been the ones mostly carrying these planks back and forth, and all of a sudden the commotion of everybody going out and grabbing a 4 or 5 foot mm-hmm. long plank of wood that was fairly heavy because it had 5 or 6 decent size ceramic pieces on it. And I was caught up in the Jacques Tati French films that are so visually full of puns and waiting for some slapstick kind of catastrophe to happen, as these people would be carrying these boards through this narrow hallway and turning the corner and somebody else would be coming the other direction. And it's just always left this image for me of the Japanese pottery situation, because it was just such a wonderful dance that they were doing.
It reminds me of an absurd situation I experienced, because I was doing the same thing. Because of the Japanese influence, I was putting my pieces on a 5 foot long board. You balance it on your shoulder and you walk into the next room to put them away for drying. Barbara came by to visit, and just as I was walking by, the board cracked, fell forward and backward. And she was so embarrassed. She just turned around and walked away. And I was standing there looking stupid, you know. And everybody was looking at me thinking, wow.
Yeah, well,
I remember Hamada was asked about what happens when it rains, and he says, well, if it rains, it rains. You know, I mean, you just got to go with it. You can't fight it. You do what you can. Mm-hmm. You don't panic. You just deal with it.
After a while, then the throwing grew into working more sculptural forms?
When I got down here, I made very little pottery. I made very little pottery ever since, you know, just when I feel like it or when I'm demonstrating and teaching, because I really like good, honest pottery. But this was the time of funk, pop, conceptualism. There were so many other ideas I wanted to explore. So some of the first things I did down here was a satirical series of figurative sculptures based on those endlessly repeated images in the art history books. And every book has the same pictures. I started treating that like pop material, like Warhol treated a soup can. It's just, it becomes dull, redundant. Why not have fun with it? So I did a series of self-portraits as art history. And there's Saint Sebastian down there, that which you probably saw when it came in, and that'll be in the show. There's one of Ghirlandaio's old man with a big rosacea nose. They're all just fun, satirical things done in low-fire ceramics with the range of colors you can get with those glazes and overglazes. That was a lot of fun. I'm always reading, and I was reading Oriental philosophy more and more. So another series came out that was based on images that came to mind, reading about the Hindu and Buddhist philosophy. Then I traveled. I had to teach art history, so I was reading about all these things around the world, and I got a sabbatical to go around looking at some of this stuff, and that was great. When I came back, my work changed again. For the most part, my work's always been conceptual. It's not like representational. It deals with an idea rather than, you know, trying to replicate something. But I did explore different styles and techniques that I picked up from other cultures as a way of exploring that culture and saying something about it, giving credit to it, for one thing, and just feeding my own curiosity. Towards the end there, I became more interested in formalism. Things became more and more reductive. I started dealing with abstract forms and the relationships of forms and what that means. And I mean, all these abstract forms have archetypal kind of meaning that everyone can respond to if they just realize it. But then looking back at my earlier work where I was doing figurative thing, it all has to do with the balance of forms, you know, the juxtaposition of round forms, square forms, linear forms, open forms, closed forms, dark forms, light forms. There's this ongoing dialogue between opposites or complements in all my work, and I think that's the essence of it, whether it's figurative or completely abstract. It's just playing around with this balance. There's a Hindu concept called asana, which is often associated with these sexual figures, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just the figurative representation of this balance and complementary relationship between opposites, but it's all done, also done with abstract forms, and it's all about balance and harmony. And I think that underlies most all my work. My graduate work that I did up at San Jose was about the balance between industrial forms and natural forms that I'd studied, lived with growing up in the country, and the forms that I saw in technology. So it's been there all along, and I just it takes different forms, different iterations, but it's all about balance.
How, for you, were you defining the term balance?
Well, I think it's unavoidable. It's something we have to cope with. We got two sides of our brain, we got two sides of our body, you know, we got males and females. Everywhere you look, there's this complementary relationship. My daughter, who has a degree in comparative religion, she says, oh, your little dualism is really simplistic. There are so many other combinations of forces out there that, you know, philosophies and religions deal with. But it's worked for me, you know, right and left, up and down, you know, black and white. It's inevitable. I mean, we just have to walk in balance.
If you're feeling out of balance with a piece, those times when something isn't working,
oh, you fix it.
Design
has to deal with balance, right? All those abstract elements of design have to be brought together in harmony, and of course, there are more than just two. But yeah, that's what design is about, making the forces work in harmony rather than antagonizing one another. Unless you want to create an antagonism, you can do it, you know?
Right.
In the end, I'm a big formalist. I think good form is what makes the difference between a weak piece and a bad piece. person can have all the good intentions in the world and make a bad piece of art if they don't know good design in new form. And I think that's more important than technique and craft, although that's extremely important. The best pieces have all those things going for them. But in the end, I think form is what justifies even naive pieces, you know, which are poorly made. If the form is right, it's going to work. It's going to work. You know, like primitive works where people really have no formal training. They can make wonderful stuff just because they have an innate sense of design.
So design is helping answer those questions and problems that show up. Are there times when you just, though mentally, can't find the answer with a piece? What do you do then?
I can usually find a design solution, but sometimes the content is boring. When I retired from teaching, I thought, well, you know, I'm tired of lifting all those big, heavy ceramics and plaster investments. I'm going to take up painting. I'd had a couple classes in college, and you know, watercolors, post-toasty watercolors and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, it looks easy, you know? It, technically and physically, it is easy. But it's damned hard to get something worth looking at, you know? a really viable, significant, new image. I don't want to do watercolors of landscapes, you know, seascapes, still lives. I was looking for something interesting and powerful. I never found anything that I was satisfied with, and I sort of let it go. I may go back to it someday, because smearing paint on is fun. I really admire people who can do that.
Yeah.
Because it's much more difficult than one might think. It's two-dimensional, except for, you know, really flat, abstract stuff. It's illusion. A lot of it is illusion. Pictorial art is an illusion, and there's nothing wrong with that, except as a sculptor, I like to use the big muscles more. I like to hammer on something. I like the stuff you can get your hands on, and it's real, you know.
The show that's coming up, there are three of you that are the original faculty at Cuesta. You are the second in the trio.
Chet was the original faculty in 65 and 67. I was hired to develop the three-dimensional program. And in 72, we hired Bob Pelfrey, who was a printmaker, could teach a drawing, and he knew art history and art appreciation. And so we were the initial threesome, the three stooges that built the program with part-time people. We got some wonderful part-timers.
The exhibits featuring the three of
the
you.
The three of us. David Prochaska conceived of this, but I think it's a wonderful thing. It's part of the 50th year celebration.
You have been listening to the first half of a conversation with Barry Franz, one of the three instructors that created and nurtured the arts education program at Cuesta College. Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, are being honored with shows at the Cuesta College Art Gallery to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the founding of Cuesta College. Chet Amix's show is currently running through September 20th. Barry Franz's show is September 27th through October 11th. And Bob Pelfrey's show runs October 18th through November 8th. The gallery, which is located on the Cuesta College campus, is open Monday through Friday, noon to 4 p.m. This is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX, located at 4100 Vachel Lane, just off of South Higuera, near Los Osos Valley Road, in San Luis Obispo, on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krissa Hewitt, thank you for tuning in. Tune in next week for the second half of our conversation with today's guest, ceramicist Barry Franz. And next month, we get to talk with Bob Pelfrey.
And that's Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Thank you for joining us.